Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Welcome to the Emerald Podcast Series. I'm your host, Tom Shields, Communications Manager at Emerald Publishing. Today, I'm joined by someone whose work sits right at the intersection of technology and society. Dr. Alexia Maddox is a sociologist interested in the experience of digital community, human technology encounters, and social change. Her latest book, Insider and Outsider Cultures in Web 3, unpacks the dynamics of this niche technology area and asks all the big questions about why we need to care about the future of the internet. I begin this episode by asking Alexia to tell us a bit about her background and how she ended up writing this book.
That's a really great question, and I will try to keep it very short and succinct. So I am a sociologist of technology, and I'm really interested in social change. And obviously technology has been a big part about how we change the way we work, the way that we interact with each other, the way that we purchase things and find things and share information and knowledge. And so I initially started with the study of digital communities, and that was for my PhD research. And that really taught me how people in very distributed places use these kinds of digital technologies to find and connect and share with each other. And the book came about, really the origin story is that I first conducted some research into online drug markets in the dark web. And that really introduced me to these kind of alternative ways of seeing the world, which include things like privacy and the ability to purchase things that you want when and how you want, and not necessarily to be heavily regulated for that, which drug prohibition tends to put a cap on, whereas people themselves desire, for example, to take drugs for leisure or to find affordable medical solutions for themselves. And so we saw a lot of the ways that people use the dark web and these kind of privacy-preserving technologies in order to buy drugs. And of course, to buy drugs, they used currencies like Bitcoin. And so that was my first real introduction into cryptocurrencies. And when I was doing that research with people, I also had to find a legal community, shall we say, where I could test the language and definitions for what it was that I was actually seeing and talking about, because it's quite a technically complex area of technology and social practice. And so I was in Melbourne at the time, and then went and found myself the first Bitcoin communities here. And obviously having to say, no, I'm not police. No, I'm not law enforcement. I am a researcher. And I'm just here to share with you what I've found in terms of my research in the dark web, and then also to test my understanding. So that began a 10-year odyssey.
So just going on to the book, Alexia, you talk about explaining Web3 dynamics to lay audiences, and how, you know, you would assume that people already know what the internet is. And as you point out in the book, most people do, but that's usually only from the perspective of how they use it in their daily lives. So are you able to provide us with some explanations of what the internet exactly is, and then more specifically what Web3 is?
I'd love to do that. And it's actually a conversation that I have quite often. So when I talk to people, I say, well, what do you think the internet is? And of course, what they think it is the World Wide Web. And how they use it, broadly speaking, is by email and social media. So for people, the internet are these sort of platform services that they're used to using. But actually, it was initially designed as a decentralized network that was meant to support communication, but not have one center that could be targeted to knock down the communication connections. And we've actually seen the sort of the evolution of the internet as we initially knew it, which we call Web 1 in the sort of, scientific version of how we discuss this. And that's really about the initial web that came about for social use around the 1990s. And that was like essentially hyperlinked documents. So you could click on one document and then click on a link and it would take you to another document. And during that time, we had our first search engines come up. And so that's where we started to learn how to search for information using keywords. And that was really our first iteration. And in that, we connected with each other. And email is another service that uses the basic communication infrastructure of the internet. But we also had forums and places that we would do like chat channels. And that was our very first way of finding each other, connecting with each other and sharing with each other. And then we started to really create and produce content for each other in those places. So that was that's sort of internet 101. And then we have the social media landscape, which then brings with it an entirely different business model, which is about your friendship networks and how you share with them and then how you can be known through those interactions and behaviors through the types of data that the platforms connect. So those are the two big shifts that most people understand. And the way that I talk about them is that they are very centralized in that all of the information that you provide goes to a platform or a service provider that controls that data. Whereas, for example, Web3 was imagined to be a decentralized peer-to-peer sharing network where you were able to be pseudonymous, so not known, for example, and to be able to have private interactions and private behaviors through encryption. And of course, when we talk about that, people think immediately, oh, that's so shady. But actually, of course, the initial desire was to remove the middleman and allow that freedom of action and also the freedom to choose how you revealed yourself and to whom.
It's really interesting. In the book, you talk about this idea of Web3 involving non-human elements in digital spaces. So can you talk a bit about that and what that looks like?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I love about Web3 is that it's a fantastic conceptual playground. And what that really means is that we're thinking about all of the human actors, so ourselves, we go online, we do things, we change things, we make decisions, we interact with each other. But we're also interacting with the technology itself. And that technology is making decisions with us, for us, and through us, and automating processes. So that's how we understand a little bit of agency in the technology environment. And of course, these days, we talk about bots as that sort of interactive aspect. Then from Web3, its foundation is essentially blockchain, which is a decentralized digital ledger. And that digital ledger is designed to carry tokens. And those tokens can carry things like payment systems, and that's where we see cryptocurrencies like a Bitcoin, and one Bitcoin is the same as the other. And then it's also able to carry non-fungible tokens, which is like one piece of artwork is different to another. And so you can own that digital item. And so when we look at that, we're starting to see information, unique information being encoded into tokens, and those tokens being used to execute value into certain decisions through automation. So that, I know it's a bit abstract, but that is actually the fundamental difference that allows us to start to think about these non-human actors or tokenized agents that then start to be able to act through automation themselves. And so when we start to think about, well, who is this or what is this token? For example, could it be a piece of environmental information that is talking about changing in weather? And then if that pattern recognition sees those changes, then it can execute a series of commands, for example, that then distribute money towards that desired goal to, for example, to intervene. And so we're starting to see almost like these synergistic systems emerge through technology.
And when it comes to designing these systems, Alexia, what do we need to think about to make sure that we're doing things ethically?
So to do things ethically, we need to have a few things very clear. First of all, we need to understand what it is that people value. And the book itself suggests that what we value is our own identities. We value the ability to own and control how our data is used, and we value transparency for how it's done and by whom and for what purpose. So in essence, as a sociologist, we're looking at power, control, and the role of the collective in decision-making. So then what values do we share that we need to design those systems around? And of course, we do need to think about the value that we have in our relationship with our environment. So, for example, we often talk about the way that our extractive systems and our waste systems are destroying the environment of the planet that we're living on, and that we do need to change that. So that would be a shared value in how you design a system. Is this system designed in order to meet and extend that goal for us? So are we designing technologies that allow us to thrive into the future and then also include all of us in the future? So who's in and who's out? So those are some really fundamental values that I think we would probably want to see encoded in technologies that shape our daily lives and affect the possibility of our future lives.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that, you know, in writing the book and over the course of your research over the years, you've come across a lot of these kind of projects. But are there any projects that really stood out to you because of their focus on the environment? You touched on the environment there. I'm just wondering if there's any specific projects that you might be able to talk about.
Yeah, definitely. So there's one fun one that never really got realized, but I loved it anyway. And then there is one real one, which I actually do look into in detail in the book. And so the first one using Web3 technologies was essentially about protecting a pod of whales. And so those whales had tracking on them, and there was a decentralized autonomous organization, a DAO, that held a treasury, and it had information about the environmental conditions around those whales. So when the whales moved in certain ways or their environmental conditions became not conducive, then the DAO would take that data and then automatically distribute funds towards intervention opportunities around that. So there was this sense that the environmental factors could feed back and then automatically almost like save themselves with that kind of human mediation, but only at the design stage was the value of people and their relationship to nature put in. So that was a wonderful proposition. But as with many Web3 ideas and tech ideas in general, they don't ever really get realized. But the one that I do talk about in the book is about an environmental wetland. And essentially what we're looking at is infrastructures, web infrastructures that can operate as nodes and hubs and be placed into areas that have poor internet coverage, because we're never going to get any information, for example, from a wetland real time, unless we've got a working communication infrastructure in it. And so a lot of the decentralized systems, we're working to provide hotspots into these wetland spaces. And the example I talk about is Kalmadema. And that one really was about putting sensors into a wetland, incentivizing people to run hotspots in order to support the data capture being processed and made real time into decision-making information that could inform how the wetland was going and its general health and ecosystem. So the principle behind that was fascinating, and we definitely saw some research studying how these kind of Web3 technologies wrapped into an incentive for people to maintain the data gathering sensing hotspots. What we saw, however, in the realization of that is that people, in order to run the hotspots, they were incentivized to run them and gain tokens from the process, which is the equivalent of a financial stake or a stock in the process. And so people started to game the system in order to mint the tokens rather than try to deliver the hotspots in order to gather the data. So we had this sort of incentivization towards, or a social engineering towards, a type of behavior that was actually counter to the purpose of the infrastructure. So that's the challenge that we often face, is that people and developers will design this idea and use the technology to deploy the idea and then incentivize people to engage collectively with that idea, but not really take into account the other sides of human behavior. So that real understanding of social practice, and that tends to be where a lot of technologies fail, because people do like to adopt them, but then they appropriate them.
People that aren't in tech and local communities that maybe won't have easy access to the kind of technology that we're talking about, how do we get these people involved in process like this, and what's the ideal for you, Alexia, in that regard?
The ideal for me is always a collective and social process. So technologies are really there as a tool, a place, and a way of being for us, but they are not the things that determine what we value, and nor are they the things that determine how we do it. So we're the designers and architects. So the first thing we need to have is a conversation about what we care about. And you can then look at the resource and expertise gaps in these communities and then see what possibilities there are to intervene and provide that support. So no, it is not the case that everyone is online or has digital access at all times with the kind of stable internet that we need in order to communicate and coordinate. But we do have social processes in place that allow us to do that. So technology is never the sort of problem-solution paradigm. It's always about what is it that people care about, and then it's a question of how do we go about doing it, and then we need to ask who's connected, how are they connected, and how can we work with the fabric that's there and reflect the values that the people hold themselves.
And when it comes to scaling these kinds of Web3 projects around the world, what do you think are the biggest challenges that are faced at the moment?
I think there's so when we talk about Web3 technology, for example, there are a few challenges. And the first one I alluded to with the Kalmadema wetland project is the incentive misalignment problem. So there's a disconnect often between the purpose, which in that case was environmental monitoring, and the decentralized collective reward structure, which was the token-based incentive. So thinking about how we actually engineer buy-in in these systems as we scale them, and thinking about what resilience looks like when there's a glitch, something drops out, or there's malicious or behavior that doesn't actually go towards the purpose, that we have accountabilities around that. So scaling and accountability is definitely, and incentive structures is definitely a large one. But of course, what we're trying to achieve is collective buy-in. So people need to believe in what it is that we're doing. And they also then need to have a means through which to engage. And then, of course, some kind of value return that acknowledges their time and effort. And that has many different ways to look at that. But that's the first question of scale. Then, of course, the second question of scale is about the environmental impact of the technologies that we're using, which require a lot of computational power. And to do that, they need, for example, if it's cloud-based, they need big data centers to do that. And we're seeing this discussion play out yet again in the generative AI space, with a lot of the Silicon Valley players really focusing on building bigger and bigger and bigger data centers that do have environmental costs to them.
And looking ahead maybe a few years and through the lens of environmental sustainability, what do you think the future of the internet or Web3, what does that look like? Are there any trends that we need to be looking at and maybe stop doing certain things or doing more of something to make sure that we do have that sustainable sort of environment?
Definitely there are. So, of course, a lot of what we see is technologies that can't be repaired. So in a very simple situation, that sort of the repair and reuse, needs to be very much at the foreground of how we develop technologies, and we need to be very thoughtful about the kinds of materials that they require and the energy required to produce them. So at an energy consumption and resource consumption and waste side, that's a very big discussion that we haven't solved, but we need to continue to have. Then we need to look at things like social sustainability. And that really comes in terms of how people are treated and how we treat each other, and then how we treat those non-human actors in our world, like the ecosystem and like even, for example, the non-human agents. So obviously, what are the core values that bind us together that allow for that kind of thriving? So that's a very big question, but that is that social sustainability, that tolerance with each other, the ability to dialogue, the ability to incorporate diversity is going to be one of those key aspects that gets us through to the future. I often say a very simple and very stupid phrase, which is the logic that got us into the pickle we're in is not the logic that's going to get us out of it. And so when we think about the need for diverse knowledges, for example, Indigenous knowledges and ways of being, how can we draw those in to look at the challenges we have and think of different approaches from what we've been taking to this point?
And that kind of leads us nicely into my next question, Alexia. You sent me an article you've written recently when we were preparing for this recording, and in it you described AI as a potential interactive journal, so a space for reflection rather than a replacement for human connection. Could you share more about this perspective?
Definitely. So I've been thinking, obviously Web3 has been a big area of practice for me, but I guess the most foregrounded technology that we're looking at right now is generative AI. And that's where there's this real sense of agency in this technology and this sense of the simulation of human interaction and companionship. And often people don't understand that at the core of this technology, it's essentially a probabilistic system that is producing the next likely word based on its training data sets. So it looks and feels and behaves and interacts as if it's human, but it's not. And it has a series of limitations that could lead us down to this question of how much we expose to it. So these are data consumption machines. They train on data sets, and they also incorporate all of the inquiries, all of the information that we give them back into those data sets. So they're hoovering us as much as they hoovered out all of the past selves that we put out online. And so just this sense of what does consent look like in this environment? And can we configure that kind of data use and permission differently? So people need to be aware of that. Then also this sense that because it feels human, looks human, sort of almost behaves human, then we're building these kind of intimate exposures with these Gen AI tools, telling them often some of our very personal lives. And in that, people might then start to think, oh, well, I don't need to go to a human being to discuss this issue. I don't need to go to a counselor, or I don't need to become vulnerable to another human being. I can just build a relationship with an AI. And so that kind of displacement challenge that we might have, it's really not an easy fix, because essentially these tools are just reading you like you're a book and giving you or regurgitating written content. They don't actually have that sentient care for you. And that kind of care and mutual reciprocity and this sort of sense of the inability to control another person, which is obviously our greatest fear but also our greatest reality, it just, that tension space is such that people would prefer perhaps to default to the safer, predictable, almost contained human. And in that, of course, we are less likely to keep that practice of vulnerability, trust building, and reciprocity, which is going to be so important in our intimate relationships, but also for the way that we build our futures together. So thinking about these Gen AI tools as not as computational caring environments, but as ways for us to workshop our thinking, our boundary practices, to use them as another tool in the kit for how we relate to the world and make sense of the world, that's fine. But the displacement is not fine.
It's fascinating stuff. And I was just wondering, like, we know the sort of from what you're saying there, that there's, you know, there's going to be issues, but what safeguards do you think we should be putting in place to protect people?
Well, the first safeguard that is always the most important is education. People do need to be aware of the way that these technologies work, what gets consumed, what about them they need to consent about, what they own, and how they should protect themselves in these environments. So that is a very important toolkit that we do have. The other side of that toolkit is that the way that people design these technologies needs to take into account the way that we care for each other and what we, the sort of providing the transparency around how they work, and then also the guardrails around how they respond to the types of things we want from them. For example, if we want to scam someone, abuse someone, violate someone, those behaviors we have decided collectively are very unhealthy, extremely toxic, and we want to moderate them. So putting the guardrails in about what these platforms allow and to whom and for what purpose, and then who controls that process, that discussion is also essential. So just designing well and understanding the limits and the potential of these tools, those two things are extremely important. And what they do require is that we have enough information around us that really helps us to build that critical literacy and enough transparency in the tools themselves so that we can see it. So that's the sort of, there's two sides to that coin at the very least.
That's fascinating. And how do you see this technology impacting creativity? And I was talking to a friend last night who is a songwriter, and he showed me that he was able to take a song that he had produced, feed it into this system that was trained on like every song on Spotify, and change the genre within seconds. The exact same song, the completely different genre, different singer and everything else. And that kind of makes you wonder, how is it going to affect music and writing and all that sort of things? What's your opinion on that?
It's going to substantially affect the creative process and the creative output. So there's this real sense that what we're looking at is synthetic media. And so, of course, the concern we have is that more and more in this environment, the Gen AI tools will be generating the content, generating the creativity. And our greatest fear is that we will lose control of that process, lose connection to any form of creative reality, and then lose these creative skills. So that, of course, is all a potential. Like I say, the internet and these tools are an example of that, releases opposing forces of emancipation and domination. So this question of who controls and where creativity sits is very central. What we would say, of course, and that's kind of in that blog I allude to, where that line is around how much the tool does and how much the human does. Our practices around creativity, writing, and productivity will change without doubt. And so, of course, with as a classic media theorist Marshall McLuhan said, with every augmentation, there's an amputation. So there are skills we will lose and skills we need to build. But fundamentally, what drives us, what enables us to thrive, is this ability to be creative, the ability to be innovative, and the ability to think critically. Those skills, we need them, and we need to continue to cultivate them. But how, for example, music is made, how, for example, artworks are produced, there will definitely be changes in practice and often in the workflow of the creator and how the product is produced. But of course, you know, in the world, there is always going to be a lot of low quality content and a lot of hacks towards what people feel creativity is, or that artistic expression of a reality that helps to make us see things differently or to see things as they really are. So we're still humans in this kind of digital web of process and practice. And the things that are most important is our ability to be creative. How we go about doing that is definitely going to change.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting time for sure.
Yeah.
Just to go back to the book, Alexia. So towards the end of the book, you have a section of call to actions. And I ask every guest this question, and it is probably one of the tougher ones, I'd imagine. And that is, what one thing would you like the reader to take away from reading the book if you had to choose just one point?
That is a very difficult question. And the one thing that I would like every reader to take away from the book is that they need to actively engage in shaping the future of their digital lives. So it is definitely not the case that you should lie down and take what's given to you, because then you will get what is given to you. And we know that that is not an ideal space. So we do need to be active. We do need to be vocal. We do need to be engaging. And we do need to have that collective action to say, no, this is what we require our digital future to look like. This is what I require in my life. How are you going to do it? And don't do what you're doing right now, because that is violating of me. So just that simple desire to actually educate yourself about how things work and then take action or become vocal or make choices that push back against the things that you feel are abusive, violating, or take away your rights, for example. So, and perhaps diminish yourself as an individual or undermine our ability to thrive collectively. So just engaging at that level is really what I want people to do. And the book is a case study that is a provocation for the different ways that we've seen technologies work and how innovation, entrepreneurship, and collective action can be both positive in its outcomes, but also have very negative effects.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. For more information on today's guest and for a transcript of the show, please visit our website. I'd like to thank Dr. Alexia Maddox and the studio. This is Distorted.